Ladies and gentlemen, we show Lars here tonight. And on the third floor, we will keep our luggage on the third floor after we have been settled. Then we proceed to the basement to eat our dinner. Right?
Wrong report.
Bring all our luggage and handbags to the third floor.
If that sounds rather confusing to you, you can't imagine how confusing it was to us that night at Sun Moon Lake. Our visit to Sun Moon Lake in mountainous central Taiwan was supposed to be the high point of our stay in Free China. But because of some confusion about lodging and the obvious disgrace of one of the fine young men who got blamed for the unavailability of hotel accommodations after we arrived, our feelings were rather ambivalent about the place. The scenery was like something out of a Chinese silkscreen painting. And we certainly will never forget the night spent in the youth hostel. Dr. Chan discovered that there was hot water in the shower after I had given up and screamed and jumped through an ice-cold shower. And the young man who was blamed for it all brought us soap and a towel and a toothbrush and tried valiantly to make amends for his errors. Personally, I enjoyed sleeping on a top bunk with this view the next morning through the trees and bird songs I had never heard before. After a breakfast most of us decided that we could get along without, we boarded the buses again and drove around the lake, pausing to take a picture of the source of the lake, this beautiful bubbling spring. We then drove to a high point overlooking the lake where there was a beautiful temple. Chinese religion being what it is, I couldn't find out just what kind of a temple it was, and the same goes for another one we visited farther along. I was told it wasn't Buddhist or Confucian, but was in honor of a famous literary figure, which was very Confucian to me. The fact that this gate had carved in the marble of its base a reproduction of a soda pop bottle cap and the name of a popular soda pop carved in it made me more than a little curious. I think it was Heisha Cola, and we had drunk some the day before, and it was pretty good. But carved in marble? Virginia poses outside, but wouldn't go in. She said she'd rather feed the two temple dogs you see here by her. Well, I asked Horst, a German missionary to Taiwan who was with our group, to bargain with this young Aboriginal Taiwan beauty queen for some of her souvenirs, commercialism on the steps of the temple. Inside, it was quite obvious that somebody had lavished a lot of care and money on this particular temple. And there was an old monk, Buddhist or not, standing near this table, and on the table were his glasses and his pen and a tablet with a prayer that he'd written in beautiful Chinese calligraphy to sell to a pilgrim, no doubt. I never did find out to whom the prayer was addressed. I wanted to buy it, but I had lost my interpreter. Under a statue that looked suspiciously like Kuan Yin, the goddess of mercy, we were told that there were some of the bones of some kind of a saint. He must have been a very little saint because they had a magnifying glass aimed at a small glass case and a larger glass case aimed at something about the size of the head of a pin. Do you suppose they prayed to that? It was at the center of all of this splendor. It was a beautiful place. But my heart ached for the millions of people who can get no closer to God than this cold, austere pile of marble, gold, and jewels. centered around a pinpoint of musty human bones and a few statues. Meanwhile, Virginia had been feeding the temple dog, and he'd gained a little weight. It's my understanding that he's supposed to frighten away evil spirits. Now, that I can understand. As far as I'm concerned, he can include me too. Back in the bus, we go down to the lowlands again. We make a roadside stop at a refreshment stand where we buy fruit and the best candied kumquats I ever ate. Dr. Chan introduced us to them, and later everybody got hooked on the things. We suspect the three bus drivers must have a financial interest in these stands, or else their relatives run them, but that's all right with us. We pass many beautiful pagodas, and so I had to photograph at least one. And a sea land trailer. Container cargo is big in the Orient. We saw a lot of it. Then we were taken on a tour of a huge new harbor complex being developed in west central Taiwan near Taichung. Here we passed stevedores unloading wheat the hard way, sacking it by hand. And the buses drive out to the end of a jetty. And we have to get out while they turn around. A storm was brewing and the sea was cutting up, and we were glad to get out while he turned around. The boulevard here along the harbor area is made wide enough to be a landing strip for fighter planes in an emergency, and with Red China just a few miles away, that's a real possibility that they have to consider. University, the largest Christian university in Taiwan. This is the chapel where art examines the ceramic roof tile. It's very modern and certainly un-Oriental. The choir entertains us at lunch. We hear them singing in the background. And they do an excellent job of Chinese and Western style music. Tables of us like this, and at the head of each table there was a faculty head of department. We had the head of the English department at our table, and we enjoyed the only box lunch that we had on our stay on Taiwan, and actually it was one of the best. The tea was very good too. After dinner, I admire this outdoor bulletin board, especially the obvious announcement announcing a meeting of some kind at the college chapel. We spend the night in a suburb of Taipei, and Virginia and I are awarded the bridal suite. Bridal suite for Cockroach's wedding, I think, but we're up early next morning to hold a prayer meeting for Dr. Chan and Julia and Art and Jane at the request of some of the missionaries who have become interested in their situation. We all pray that God would move our immigration department to relent from their implacable and inexplicable opposition to our desire to allow the sweet little refugee from communist China to bless the home of Art and Jane and to relieve the fears of her father for her safety. Dr. Chan says, "I have lived my life and am an old man and not afraid to die, but I want my daughter to have a chance to live and be free, and so pray we all." After a good Western-style breakfast, we are bussed in a drizzle to downtown Taipei, and we walk from here to the presidential building that you can see in the distance. There's a steady drizzle all over Taiwan. When we arrive at our reserved seats right across from the presidential box, we decide being a distinguished foreign visitor could be all wet. Maybe we're the only ones not dry behind the ears, because it's 4 hours before the parade begins. And look at all the smart folks who stayed at home. But soon it's comforting to look around. You know, misery loves company, even when you're a distinguished foreign visitor, or is it extinguished? But who could stay glum in a crowd of characters like this? Virginia and Dr. Chan try on distinguished foreign visitor smiles and brighten up the place. When the army starts handing out umbrella hats like this, we all decide to let a smile be our umbrella. We even manage to sing a few of our choruses to the amusement of those who've gathered around us. And we get some rather unusual looks. Nobody sane could sing at a time like this, or could they? Maybe he's trying to request raindrops falling on my skin or head. The stand in the background is where the parade marshal stood, along with television cameras. The president's box is that covered area across the street. The commanders of the Army, Navy, Air Force, and Marines pass in review. And then the various services marched smartly by, and the bands sounded like bands ought to sound. They goose-stepped past the president and past us. The parade ended with thousands of balloons being released. Some of them contained fireworks and flags and colored smoke bombs and so on. And the crowd roared its approval. Then we slopped damply back to our bus. Whoever planned things really had a stroke of genius at this point. They bussed us to a Chinese restaurant that specializes in Sichuan foods. That's the northern area of China up near the Manchurian border, where the hot pepper reigns supreme. And as far as I was concerned, that was the perfect antidote for the drizzles. Truly heartwarming. We dry out with spicy barbecued pork and hot soup and lots of other goodies. Jane is enthusiastic, and she's glad she learned how to handle chopsticks so well. While Art still figures he'd rather have a hamburger, the little badge he's wearing was the proof that we were distinguished foreign visitors. While nearby, a distinguished not-so-foreign visitor gives her seal of excellence to the food while her mother looks on approvingly. She's the daughter of one of our interpreters, that is, the mother is, and she was educated in the United States. She sampled the soup and pronounced it good, while her mother and uncle await her verdict, and Granddaddy proudly admits they belong to him. We'll remember Taiwan as the place of the great eat-out, 3 meals a day, in as many different places, served in different ways for 8 days, each one an adventure. Friend says, "All you distinguished foreign visitors, use your noodle and come back to see us. Y'all here?" Finally, the week comes to an end, and we say goodbye to Julia and Taiwan and fly across the China Straits to Hong Kong. This is the first land we sight. Then this, and this. And banking around Kowloon with Hong Kong Island on our right, we turn in to land at Kai Tak Airport. Jimmy Ko, shown here hosting a Sunday dinner for us at his hotel in Kowloon, has his hotel bus meet us at the airport, and we're brought to the Hotel Imperial. It's right in the middle of the busiest part of Kowloon, the section called Tsim Sha Tsui. Yep, that's it, Tsim Sha Tsui. We just happened to pass this church one night, and I asked Jane to pose by it. By day and by night, our hotel was where it's at. And the streets are an ever-changing kaleidoscope of color. The view from our window was slightly obstructed by bamboo scaffolding as they were remodeling the hotel 16 stories up. That's Hong Kong across the harbor. You can make out the Peak Tram building and the little depression at the top of the ridge. Down on the waterfront, a new aquarium is being built right in front of the old Peninsula Hotel. We ride the double-decker bus out to Yuen Long with Mandy, one of Dr. Chen's clinic helpers, whom he sends in to chaperone us. He's afraid we can't find it by ourselves. Mandy's in the center. I like the double-decker because of the visibility from up there. This is typical of the scenery along the road in the new territories on the way to Yuen Long. If you're high up in a bus, you can see things like this. And we pass a Buddhist school with some kind of an announcement of a celebration or important event at the main gate. Passing through the countryside, farmlands, and the estates of the wealthy, as well as several satellite towns, we finally approach Yuen Long, about 10 miles from Hong Kong toward the border with Red China. As you can see, it's no village. This is Tung Lok Street, the street Dr. Chan's clinic is located on. His sign, reading Grace Clinic, hangs over the street. His clinic is on the second floor of an old building. Because we were coming, Dr. Chan had arranged to close his clinic that afternoon, and the young refugee doctor who now works with him in the clinic and his three assistants are quite happy because it means a delicious Chinese dinner at a nearby restaurant. It's dim sum. The food is brought on by on carts, and if you read and speak Chinese, you can select what you like in pretty little bamboo steamer baskets. It's a happy, interesting experience. The Chinese are excellent hosts, and some of the food is delicious. Restaurants in Hong Kong are big business. I don't know whether anybody eats at home. Usually there are several floors like this with seating for hundreds or even thousands on each floor. And there are all mob scenes like this at mealtimes. Good-natured people, each trying to be heard over the noise that other people are making, trying to be heard over the noise. And the waiters pushing the carts, crying out their wares, have the job of being heard over all that. But it's fun, and food is plentiful and cheap, and it's sometimes rather exotic. After lunch, while Dr. Chan arranges to close down the clinic, we bargain with a deaf and dumb man on the street who carves chops, the ivory and plastic signature stamps, so much a part of Chinese correspondence, art, and business. Wish I'd thought to ask for the conversation, the written conversation between Mandy, Lisa, and the man, in the deaf and dumb man in Chinese scribbles, with an occasional sketch thrown in by me. We finally agreed on what we wanted and what he wanted for payment. Then Dr. Chan tried to find two taxis that would agree to take us to the Chinese border. Somehow they don't like to go near it. Across the street you can see some very valuable merchandise. Those are dried shark's fins in the window. A most important ingredient for any self-respecting Chinese feast, shark's fin soup. We finally convinced Dr. Chan that it's not our favorite dish, but it's considered the ultimate in pleasing a guest. I suppose because it's very expensive. It's served at all wedding feasts, and unless you can get out of it to every foreign guest they want to impress or honor, it sort of tastes like rubber band soup to me. We found the taxis and proceeded to Lo Wu, which is a favorite tourist stop where you can look across a riverbed to Red China. I don't think Dr. Chan's nurses had ever been here because they were very much interested and took more pictures than I did. The young assistant to Dr. Chan was educated in Malaysia and was deported to China in recent years as a result of Indo-Chinese backlash against China. He then was sent to Hong Kong on the daily train that runs from Canton. They didn't want him either, because he had known too much freedom in Malaysia, and might be a troublemaker. It's ironic that hundreds are expelled from China this way each week, while all along the border there are armed guards and watchtowers with watchdogs to keep people from escaping. It would be almost impossible to cross here, even though fish farmers live in that no man's land. You can be sure they are being watched. The little elevated area just beyond the larger island-like formation is the cross the border and is in Red China. The mountains in the background, of course, are also part of the Chinese mainland. You can see guards watching you through binoculars if you rent a pair from the concessionaire. I wonder if they're really just communist tourists over there who have rented their binoculars from the cousin of the woman who rents them on this side, you reckon? From Lo Wu, Dr. Chan has the taxis take us to a place not on the usual tourist stop. It's a place where we can see across a portion of Mers Bay to a most interesting village. Across there, the border runs down the middle of the street. People on one side are in Hong Kong New Territories, and on the other, they're in Red China. It seems crazy, but that's real life, and that's the way it is. How it's controlled is beyond me, but it would mean imprisonment or death to be a stranger there. This is as close as we can get to it. Dr. Chan explains to Art and his assistant, who is just as interested since this is his first visit, that the building on the left is in Hong Kong New Territories and the one on the right is Communist Chinese. And then Dr. Chan takes a picture of Shirley Renard with Red China in the background, probably to send to his daughter Jenny, now becoming an American citizen and a college student in Mississippi. Shirley is her adopted mother, and Jenny, just a few years ago, made the dangerous nighttime swim farther down the coast, where chances of being caught were less, but where the distance and sharks and patrol boats deter all but the very brave. Thank God Jenny made it to bless the Renard family with her love and charm. I suppose Shirley might have been voicing a silent prayer of thanks and gratitude at this point. To add a note of unreality to the scene, these two cars were movie makers with photography and sound equipment inside. They were making a film here and along the road with China in the background. I'd like to make one of the experiences of the little doctor who's come away from 20 years under communism and who has so far drawn three of his children, a close friend, and a nephew to make the same dangerous decision and risk their lives to swim to the relative freedom of Hong Kong. The taxis took us to Tai Po, a town on the railroad from Canton to Hong Kong, and the place where Virginia and I used to catch the ferry that runs out to the islands off the coast between Hong Kong and China. It was there that we saw the bodies brought ashore of swimmers who tried to escape from China and were shot by communist patrols. We caught the train into Hong Kong, saying goodbye to Dr. Chan and his staff. They had devoted a whole afternoon to us, and it was an experience most of us, including the young doctor and the three girls, would always remember. The train passes along the coast, a beautiful trip by the Hong Kong Chinese University in Sha Tin, the site of a new multi-million-dollar horse race track and floating seafood restaurants, and through Lion Rock Tunnel, past the house where we had lived during our year in Hong Kong. But Virginia's tired and catches a few winks while Mandy, still carrying her day's responsibility of being our guide, talks to Art and Jane and Shirley. It's dark when we arrive back in Kowloon, the end of the line, and I'm glad Mandy is still with us because she points out these Chinese who were on the train with us. They're arriving in Hong Kong for the first time. These are some of the deportees kicked out of China and sent to be an embarrassment to the Hong Kong government with everything they possess in a little cloth bag. Mandy tells us, they're saying, what's that? They've never seen an escalator before, and they're afraid. They also show fear when they realize that I'm taking pictures of them. This is the way the young doctor who assists Dr. Chan arrived in Hong Kong not too long ago. It seems the criminals, the feeble-minded, the too old to work, are not the only ones not wanted in communist China. Those who might be infected by the virus of freedom and an education are also unwelcome. Next day, it's Lisa's turn to be our guide. And she's at the hotel bright and early, all excited, because she's going to take us on a trip to the top of Hong Kong's Peak by way of the Peak Tram, an inclined railroad. And she's never been. She had been well schooled by Dr. Chan as to how to take us places by taxi and so on, but I countermanded his orders. After all, this was our territory now. Virginia and I know all the cheap ways around Hong Kong and downtown Kowloon, so we go first to the Ocean Terminal, just a couple of blocks from our hotel, full of hundreds of shops like this. This is what Hong Kong is all about for most tourists. The Ocean Terminal is two or three stories of air-conditioned mall, with each shop like a museum, an art exhibit, where everything is for sale. You'll find priceless treasures alongside cheap little souvenirs. Certainly it's a window shopper's paradise. And occasionally you'll even find something you'll want to buy. For instance, in this shop there are pictures, some reproductions of famous paintings, some scenery like the Great Wall of China or the famous flying Chinese horses, all done in petit point. Some of them are 6 feet by 4 feet in size, representing years of work by needlepoint artists. All done for the benefit of the Communist Party by smiling, happy peasants. Ask them. The Chinese Communist Party, that is. Boy, would I like to talk to the needlepoint artists. We cross the ferry to Hong Kong. It's an island, you know, across from Kowloon. We always travel second class because the people down here are more interesting than the tourists topside. Ferries run every 3 or 4 minutes and cost, still, with inflation, about 4 cents. I insisted that we take a minibus to the top of the peak. It's much more exciting than the slow peak tram cable car, and you see a lot more for about half the cost. The double-deck bus is even cheaper, and from the top deck, the ride up those winding, precipitous roads can be a thrilling experience. Shirley says, "I can see our hotel from here." The view of Kowloon across the harbor is one you never forget. It has changed a lot since I first came here over 20 years ago, but then, so have I. Art tries to get it all on film, and Virginia says, "Hey, there's more to see that way." We eat lunch in the restaurant in the Peak Tram building, and little Lisa says, "This is a great responsibility for me. I have never entertained 5 foreign visitors before." So we let her pay the check because we know that Dr. Chan had prepared her to pay for everything, and so far I had overruled him. It was a big thrill for her, obviously, and a big day. Then we went down in the Peak Tram to where we could catch the double-decker tram that runs through Hong Kong out to Sha Ke Wan, about a 5-mile trip for about 4 cents. One of the most exciting sightseeing trips in the world, and undoubtedly the cheapest. I suspect that this was a first for Lisa also. We sent a tired Lisa back to Yuen Long after that. But that night, Dr. Chan came to take us to dinner. In the restaurant, there was a topographical map, and I asked him to point out the area in Mers Bay where he and his children had made the swim out of China. He said this is where Julia and her brother crossed. They were forced by increased vigilance to start farther to the right than he had. This is the island they landed on. They were picked up by villagers who were going to turn them over to the Chinese patrols who come by constantly and whom they fear very much. But Julie and her brother told them that they were looking for her father. They told them if they were telling the truth, they'd let them go. And that's why the Hong Kong police had them when Virginia and I first heard they had made the crossing safely 5 years ago when we were praying for their deliverance. Dr. Chan said he swam across farther to the left and had less distance to swim, but I guess it's getting increasingly more difficult. It's a long way from dodging watchdogs, guard towers, armed foot patrols, gunboats with 50 caliber machine guns at ready, sharks, and braving an icy ocean waters at midnight. And this view from the top of the Sheraton Hotel, a view of Hong Kong across the harbor. But Dr. Chan makes the transition easily. He wants us to enjoy the view that he certainly must appreciate as a free man. To get there, you ride in this elevator, which goes up the outside of the building. Virginia says, Well, I'm aboard, but I'm not promising to look out the window. I do, and gulp, it's a long way down there. But then after all, what difference does it make if an elevator falls down a shaft 20 stories up inside or outside? It had the same end result, and I do mean end. But we make it to the dimly lighted roof garden, where we order Chinese tea and I overexpose a few shots in order to show you what living high on the hog is like in Hong Kong. But the view out the window, in spite of reflections, is worth it all. This is one of the most beautifully lighted scenes in the world. I'm sorry my photographic ability wasn't equal to the occasion. Sunday we went to church in our English language Southern Baptist church, Kowloon Baptist Church, and we were met by Jimmy and Barbara Coe, who have invited us to dinner at their hotel where we're staying after church. The brown sign in the lower right-hand corner says, Kowloon Baptist Church, all welcome. And the other sign says, no waiting. I suppose they're trying to tell us something? We came in a double-decker bus like the one in the background, and we didn't have to wait. But after church, Jimmy's chauffeur must have goofed off because we had to wait a few minutes until he drove up in the Coe's brand new Lincoln Continental. I'd hate to even think about what one of those would cost in Hong Kong. But we bus riders rode back to the hotel in style. And to Art's delight, enjoyed a Western-style dinner in the hotel dining room. The girl was one of our Sunday school girls when I was pastor of Bethany Baptist Chapel years before in Kowloon. Her Christian name is Alice Choi, and she was invited along too. Dr. Lam, one of our former church members, has also joined Kowloon Baptist Church along with the Coes and with Dr. Chan. He had dinner with us and then went with Art to a nearby camera shop. Back in the hotel, Art explains to Alice and Jane and Jimmy that he's become a camera expert. Then Dr. Chan brings us a huge batch of pictures taken by a real expert. He'd taken hundreds of pictures on Taiwan and already had them developed. I think he had the time of his life while we were there. I know we did, and we'll never forget the pink lady the night he decided that Hong Kong McDonald's wasn't the right place for us. But the time had come for us to leave, so it was back to airports and waiting. Notice how pale and unwilling we are to leave. We flew to Taipei, and then to Tokyo and Hawaii. This time we were able to survey a couple of the islands as we were leaving. But the big moment was landing at Orlando and seeing the welcome that Shirley Renard received to the applause of bystanding throngs. And the way our home beckoned to us through the trees and Lake Joanna spoke words of peace. It was good to be back with the saints at Umatilla and to realize that they were glad to see us. But for a while, you'll pardon us if we duck when we hear the song, So Send I You.